From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters. Now it's getting close to the end of our season. It's just this episode, episode 139, episode 140, and then we're off for the summer. So that means that we're coming up here on the time for our second annual Here Be Monsters Summer Art Exchange. We started this out last year. This was a project where we had listeners from around the world send original art to each other. It was really amazing to see what everyone made last year. So Beth and I were talking and we said, yeah, absolutely, this is something we should do again this year. So the signups are open right now. All you have to do is fill out a short form on our website. Just go to hbmpodcast.com/art. And yeah, we're looking forward to seeing what you make. Enjoy the show. You're home. What do you see out your window right now?
Not very much, actually. I can see a bit of a building, a bit of a block of flats, and a few trees, and that's about it.
Yeah. Like, do you miss being in Iraq right now?
Yeah. I mean, I love being in, particularly at Shanidar, because you know it's. I mean, it's really incredible. If you're standing up at the cave, you can actually see quite a long way. It's sort of up the dead end, if you like, of a smaller valley. But you can see right down to the main valley where the River Zarb is. It's sort of slightly mountainous looking. And depending on the time of year, it varies a great deal. So in the spring, everything is very lush and green. Whereas in the late summer, it's very, very hot. So the whole landscape is very parched. It's sort of very yellow and a lot of the grass has died back and everything. So it's quite a different appearance. The sounds are amazing. Actually, in the cave itself, there are a number of bird species that live either in the cave or just above the cave. And they can be actually quite noisy. But for me, the sound of them is really evocative of actually being in the field. That association is so strong, kind of working away and hearing them in the background, quietly or not so quietly. We see loads of different wildlife. There's sometimes birds of prey circling above the cave. We see wild ibex sort of scampering up the rocks. There's kind of a cliff face off to the left, and they seem to scamper up this kind of vertical cliff face. And then actually out, sort of looking straight out from the cave, there's actually fields as well. So there are herds of sheep and also cows living out there too. And sometimes when it's really quiet, you just hear the kind of quiet tinkle of the bells around their necks and things. And it's, yeah. On a Friday, which is kind of the weekend there, it can be a lot less tranquil because actually a lot of visitors come to the site, which is wonderful. And they will turn up in kind of big car loads of extended families or big bus loads from a school or a university with their music blaring and out for a day out, you know. And then you have the chatter of lots of people and the music playing in the car park while everyone's having their picnics and it's a very different atmosphere, but it's wonderful too, because people there are so proud of their heritage and it's an important place for them to come visit. Not only because of the association with Neanderthals, and there's a great awareness there of how important Shanidar Cave is as a Neanderthal site, but it has a much more recent importance as well. In the sort of 80s, I think, and 90s, when the Kurds were being persecuted by Saddam Hussein, some people actually hid sort of in the cave or just up above the cave. So we have spoken to a few people who've come back and said, oh, yeah, you know, I spent time hiding here. Or, you know, even one guy came and said to us, I was actually born in the cave, which is amazing. So it really does feature in people's sort of cultural identity quite strongly. Yeah. I am sad not to be there. It's an amazing place.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
a very familiar reaction to death.
The podcast about the unknown.
So I'm Dr. Emma Pomeroy. I am a lecturer in the evolution of health, diet and disease in the Department of Archaeology at the University of Cambridge. And my role in the Shardar Cave project has been in the excavation and the ongoing analysis of the new Neanderthal remains. So we're looking for kind of hints in the archaeological record that might tell us about their world and their lived experience. What was it like to live as a Neanderthal? What was life like? How did people interact with each other? So actually how they conceptualized the world is obviously really hard to know, because the ideas don't preserve in that way. And of course, one of the big questions with Neanderthals is, did they bury their dead, and did that have any sort of ritual significance? Because it tells us more about how they were thinking and what they were capable of thinking, and how similar or dissimilar they were from us.
What is the term that I should be using here? Is it early humans? Is it archaic humans? Is it hominids? Is it something else entirely?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a difficult one to answer, actually, because people have different opinions. It very much depends on the context, I guess. I would perhaps use archaic humans, but I don't like that. Archaic has a kind of implication of people being a bit backwards, and that's not a good connotation, like, to have that implicit assumption. Yeah, not straightforward though.
I mean, let's talk about some of those misunderstandings and like that, like, assumption of like being backwards, being slow, being like less than us. Like, what do you see coming up that kind of grinds your gears?
So this kind of idea that modern humans are sort of a pinnacle of intelligence, and that other species are more primitive, less intelligent, less sophisticated, is quite an old idea, and perhaps a deep-rooted one since the first evidence of our fossil ancestors were found. And that's persisted for a long time. And I guess it's just an assumption that's made, part of it coming perhaps from this idea that humans are uniquely intelligent. Modern humans are uniquely intelligent. So by default, you know, species that have gone before us and died out must have been less clever and less sophisticated. That's why they're not here anymore. Some of the reconstructions of the early finds of, say, Neanderthals also didn't help the situation. So there's famous reconstructions of a Neanderthal from La Chapelle aux Saints in France. And he was actually relatively old for a Neanderthal and had some back problems, some arthritis, things like this. And he was reconstructed in that kind of archetypal, sort of hunched, primitive-looking position. And that really persisted for a long time, that idea of kind of knuckle-dragging, unintelligent sort of cavemen bashing things with rocks and clubs and grunting. And it's only really when people, perhaps in sort of the middle and later 20th century, start to say, okay, well, what's the evidence for this? When perhaps can we see the origins of things like language or more complex behaviour, things like art and symbolism? Where can we actually see the evidence? Where, if we don't assume that these other species weren't capable, because it must have arisen at some point in our evolution. And then, of course, once people start to be more open-minded about that possibility, you start being able to actually see the evidence that's there, and our views are less clouded by those kind of assumptions.
You know, and to that point, as I was kind of looking into this and like replaying some of the things that I've learned about Neanderthals, like from my own life, I realized that I had that you know, sometime earlier in my life, I had that kind of assumption of like the Neanderthals, like less than human, kind of, you know, died out from being too stupid to compete with us or something like that. And then I also, at the same time, I think I was digesting the work of Dr. Solecki, who, tell me what you know of Dr. Solecki.
So I'm incredibly sad that I never actually got to meet him, but sadly he died last year, just over a year ago, at the grand age of 101. And he was a real pioneer in the field. His findings at Shenandoah Cave in particular have really played a massive part in shaping how we understand Neanderthal behaviour. If you like, he was one of these people who entertained the idea that actually perhaps they weren't so different from us. And so it was worth looking for evidence of the kind of behaviour that we think of as being associated with modern humans. So things like compassion and care for one another, compassion for the dead and mourning, those kind of ideas. And I guess that was partly his outlook, but also shaped at the same time by what he found.
He was in the cave, right? He was in Shenandoah Cave, the same cave that you work in. And he was digging in the 1950s. And what did he find?
Yeah, 1951 to 1960. He actually dug a huge trench with the help of local workmen it was in the middle of the cave. And he managed to dig all the way down in one part to the bedrock, which was some 15 meters below the surface. So he and his team, they found the remains of 10 Neanderthal individuals.
How significant was the finding of those 10 skeletons?
It was hugely significant for a number of reasons. So, for example, Shenandoah 1 was an individual who had actually suffered quite a lot during his lifetime. It seems that he had suffered a head injury to the left side of his head, possibly when he was sort of in his late teens or early adulthood. That's likely to have blinded him in one eye. And it was also noticed that he had a very withered upper right arm. So, which suggests when the bone's kind of withered away, it suggests you're not able to use that arm. And actually the arm was missing then from just above the elbow. And it seemed that that might well have happened during life. So it seems like he's got a partly paralysed upper body. There's evidence that he was probably reasonably deaf because he's got bone forming in the bony ear canals of his ears. Notable arthritis in some of his joints. He'd had breaks to bones in his feet. So many challenges to life. And yet he survived into his 40s and possibly a little later, which is a good age for Neanderthals. The way it's been interpreted is that he must have had some support from his social group. And again, that might not sound that radical from the point of view of modern human populations, because we support, you know, elderly people, sick people all the time. But again, it's part of this idea that Neanderthals wouldn't have had that compassion for each other and wouldn't have cared for each other in that way. But it's thought that because of these disabilities, the partial blindness, the deafness, only being able to use part of his body, he probably couldn't have survived without the help of other individuals. One of the other big significant finds from Shenandoah Cave was also what's known as the flower burial. So this is also referred to as Shenandoah 4. This was an individual who they interpreted as a intentional burial. And they took soil samples from around the bones and analysed those for pollen. That analysis was actually done by a specialist, Arlette Leroy-Goran. And she found clusters of pollen within those soil samples, and clusters of pollen in a way that she didn't find from samples taken elsewhere in the cave. And that led her and Ralph Solecki to argue that this individual had been buried with flowers around the body, which would suggest a very, very human and a very familiar reaction to death and treatment of the body of this individual. that interpretation itself became rather controversial. And a lot of the discussion of that flower burial has focused on that one individual. But actually, the interesting part of that story as well is that it wasn't just a single individual. There was actually a cluster of four individuals there. So Shanidar 4, the flower burial, was the one on top. But directly below that were at least two more adults and the partial skeleton of a baby as well.
It's a very ripe place for me to project my imagination on Shanidar 4 and the other individuals who are found with all this pollen around them, because there's part of my brain that says, like, well, there's a lot of wind in the world, you know what I mean? And
right,
you know, and then I think I read some other analysis from some other scientists that said that there were, you know, rodents living nearby that were carrying flowers around and stuff like that, and what's to say they weren't just dropping them off in the cave. But do any of those alternative explanations or how there was so much pollen found around this individual, do any of those ring true to you or plausible even?
Yeah, a number of them are plausible. Obviously, we can't go back in time, and excavation is destructive by nature. You know, once you've excavated something, it's gone. You have one opportunity. Something that argues against, say, just the wind is that the clusters of pollen were in sort of suggested that whole flowers were there rather than just wind-borne pollen. In terms of the burrowing rodents, that is a possibility. The counter-argument, which is really interesting and something that I actually read in some of Ralph Zalecki's correspondence at the Smithsonian Institution last summer when I was there, was a letter from the pollen specialist, Arlette Leroy-Gorin. And she had written a response to this one particular article. And she said, well, it doesn't make any sense because actually some of these flowers, for example, hollyhocks, they grow on the top of very, very long stems. And so the burrowing rodents, the only way they'd really get those flowers is they'd have to climb up the stems, pluck them and carry them down. And she said it's just implausible. Part of the argument as well, so yes, wind could bring in pollen. It could also be trampled in, say, on people's feet, on people's clothing. There were even some accounts that said some of the workmen liked to tuck some flowers into the belts of their trousers. Just to, you know, brighten things up. So it could have even come from contemporary contamination. And one thing we have to remember is that these samples were being collected in 1960, and this was really pioneering. You know, now we have much stricter protocols for making sure we get uncontaminated samples and that we get what we can call control samples from other parts of the site so that we can eliminate things like burrowing, rodents, or the effects of pollen being blown in. But this was the early days of these kind of techniques, so they didn't think of, or they didn't realise that perhaps those procedures would be necessary. So it's been hard to sort of convincingly rule out those other explanations, I think. So I have to admit, I was rather a sceptic when I first joined the Shanidar Cave project because, I'd heard all of these doubts expressed in the academic literature. And while we couldn't prove one particular scenario, it just seemed likely that there were other explanations. As scientists, we want to see evidence, and you could speculate endlessly. I'm not necessarily as skeptical now as I once was. And that's partly because of the new findings that we've made.
Yeah. Can we talk about the new findings, actually? Because, like...
Yeah, sure.
So that was the 50s, right, when Dr. Zalecki was there. And what is that, 65 years or so later, you and your team decided to go back to the cave, right?
Yes. So perhaps a little less. So he last excavated there in 1960 and did try to go back, but was unable to. And then it was actually the Kurdish regional government who approached Professor Graham Barker to start new excavations at the site. And out of that invitation grew a new project to go and investigate or reinvestigate, if you like, Shanidar Cave with all of the, you know, amazing developments in archaeological science and archaeological techniques that have happened since 1960. And there are many open questions from some of that earlier work. So to put that in a better context is the most valuable thing we can do.
So my understanding is that you and your team showed up at the cave and there was a big hole in the ground. And then you're just like, okay, let's keep going.
So actually, that's not quite the case. The trench that Selecki dug, and I mentioned it, it had gone right down to sort of 15 meters from the surface, had actually filled back in over the years. I also mentioned before that there were herders living in the cave, and they used to keep their sheep and goats in the cave some of the time, and basically it was a convenient hole for chucking all your rubbish. So it had filled up with rubbish and goat poo and soil and all these things. So there was a bit of a dip where you could see where the original trench was, but it was basically filled back up. And so again, my colleagues on the project, before I really joined the project, had the huge task of removing what we call the backfill. So this is all the material that's gone into the trench since it was first excavated. So we've not gone all the way down to where Selecki did. And what we're really doing is a much smaller scale excavation. So we've reopened parts of his trench. We're basically doing extra excavations just at the edges of where he worked.
So you're down in the trench, and you and a bunch of other people are down in this trench. And what did you actually find?
The intention was never to find any more Neanderthal remains, actually. It was much more to get a detailed understanding of the chronology, so the timing of the use of the cave, the environment, things like that. But actually, it turned out that they did find more Neanderthal remains. So we were re-excavating in the area where that original Shandar IV individual was found, that flower burial. So we were just sort of cleaning the wall of the excavation and started to notice that there were some bones which were either human or Neanderthal. But when we first saw the remains in the wall of the trench, we were able to make a number of observations. So you could actually see the line of a rib cage that was a bit squashed, but it looked like it was in anatomical position. And also a clenched hand, a right hand, with the fingers curled round. And again, that looked like it was pretty much in anatomical position. We were able to apply various modern techniques. So, for example, what we call soil micromorphology. So that's where you actually take a small block out of the wall of the excavation. But then what you can do is soak it with a kind of resin and then slice it very thinly to look at the microscopic structure of the sediment, because that can tell you very interesting things about how that sediment accumulated. And in the micromorphology, we can see that the sediment just beneath the sediment with the bones is compressed. That is very suggestive that actually a hole was dug on purpose to put this individual in. We could also say from the appearance of the sediment that the bones were contained in, that it accumulated quite quickly. So it wasn't just sort of natural filling up over the years. It actually was probably all put in at the same time, again, suggesting an intentional covering of the body with sediment. I should probably mention, though, that there are many reasons why you might bury a body. So some of that could be really practical, just to, you know, if you're living in a cave, you don't want to attract scavengers, and you don't want the smell of a decomposing body. So you might just bury it for practical reasons. So we're interested not just in the idea that it might be an intentional burial, but for these signs that there might be symbolic components to it, because that suggests something about their way of thinking, having compassion for each other, perhaps ideas of mourning that we associate as being very, very human. What was also important was that we could see plant remains, so mineralized ancient plant remains. That's really important because it has some implications for these arguments about the flower burial. We can say actually that these remains are plants that have been preserved from that time. It's not modern contamination.
So you picture them in your head, right? When they were alive, right?
Definitely. Yeah, to an extent. It's, I guess I don't have a picture as such, but I do have an idea, I guess, a concept of what they were like. And I think, you know, what was this person like? How old were they? Were they a mum? Were they a dad? Were they healthy?
If you could go back to the time when you were studying, right? We're talking like 50 to 80,000 years ago ish, right?
Yeah.
If you could just fly back in time, what is like the number one thing that you would want to see, that like unanswered question that's just so hard to know?
I mean, I would love to see how they communicate. So I guess language. It's a really tantalizing question as to what linguistic capabilities were in previous species. To my mind, Neanderthals must have spoken, and I think they must have had fairly complex language like we do, but we don't know, and it's so hard to get evidence for, because language itself doesn't preserve, and because the parts of the anatomy that produce language are all what we call soft tissue, so they're not bone. And even if they were bony, you know, how much we could actually say about what that language was actually like. You know, it's not just about your anatomy, it's about how your brain works and all sorts of other things, your culture. So I think that would be absolutely fascinating. And to be actually, I mean, this is really pushing it, but I guess then to be able to understand their way of communication and actually be able to say, well, so why do you do this? And, you know, what do you think is going to happen to this person that you've just buried? Is there an afterlife? What do you reckon on the world? Those are some of the big questions that we're trying to get at. And ultimately we can, I guess, you know, up to a point, we can only speculate. So it would be amazing to actually see what they thought of their world.
Dr. Emma Pomeroy co-wrote a paper that was recently published in Antiquity, and that paper described her and her team's findings in Shanidar Cave. We have a link to the full paper up on our website. And around the same time that Dr. Pomeroy and I were talking, there was another team in France that had just discovered the world's oldest piece of string, and they found that piece of string at a Neanderthal site. And I think the implications of that finding could also be really interesting to what we talked about on this episode. So that paper was published in Scientific Reports, and we have a link to that as well up on our website. Again, that's hbmpodcast.com. Now, also on our website, signups are open for the Here Be Monsters Summer Art Exchange. And that's a project that we tried out for the first time last summer, and it went really well. And it's where you get paired with another listener, and you make a piece of art for them, and they make a piece of art for you, you pop it in the mail, and then you have a piece of art from a stranger. It's incredibly simple, and I've actually gone through the sign-up process and simplified it even more so that as many listeners as possible can get connected to each other in this time when I think a lot of people are feeling disconnected from each other. We're going to be starting the exchange right when the season ends, so be sure to sign up soon. You can do that by filling out the short form on our website, which is hbmpodcast.com/art. My name is Jeff Entman. I produce this episode of Here Be Monsters with help from Bethany Denton. Music from The Black Spot and Phantom Fauna. Here Be Monsters is distributed by KCRW. Our senior editor there is Kristen Lepore. We get additional support for freelance contributions from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.